Thank you. It's a blessing and a privilege to be with you. And anytime we can gather together to study God's Word, that's always a sacred time. One of my favorite quotations comes from a man named Walter Kaiser, who's an Old Testament student. And he just simply said, "The books of history tell us what God's people did, but the books of poetry tell us how they felt." And when you stop and think about it, every song and every poem had some catalyst, had some reason, had something that took place that captured the mind of the writer. And my second semester at Oklahoma Christian, we had a wonderful older lady, a bit eccentric, Miss Dillingham. And she would just say, "Young men, as you preach, sometimes poetry says something that prose can't say." So you stop and think about it. The books of history tell us what they did. The books of Psalms tell us how they felt. And this wonderful collection, Israel's Hymn Book, opens by saying, "Happy is the man." And what immediately are we talking about? An emotion. We're talking about a blessing. Happy is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, or sits in the seat of scoffers, but, emotion, his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. And here's the imagery: he shall be like a tree planted by rivers of water. He brings forth his fruit in his season. His leaf will not wither. All that he does will prosper. But the ungodly, they're not so. They're like the chaff which the wind will drive away. And therefore, and the discussion about what God will do with the ungodly and the things that will happen to them. But this whole psalm will open with this exclamation of, here's what is happy. I want to be sure and just cover, of all things, the last four psalms, but literally the last verse. Do any of you know from memory right off, what does the last verse in Psalms say? Let everything that breathes do what? Praise the Lord. At Eastside, and I don't know currently, but for Eastside for decades, we had a family of mockingbirds that lived kind of in the shrubbery. And if you came and just kind of sat there in the parking lot, you'd hear ta da 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 ta da. And for decades, when I've been at church camp, whether we're in Australia or here, I've told our young people, especially those who live in urban areas, if you will listen, all around the world there is a symphony of God's creatures that, because they breathe, guess what they do? They praise the Lord. And I've sat there some days in my car and just rolled down the windows, and why is it called a mockingbird? Because 60% of its calls are imitations and mocking of other bird sounds. You'll hear robins, you'll hear all kinds of stuff, and it's one bird. He is an imitator. And I thought, he's not made in the image of God in terms of having a soul. He is not made of the same substance as we are. Christ didn't die for him. Wouldn't it be embarrassing if this mockingbird instinctively praised God more and better today than I do? Happy is the man. Let everything that breathes praise the Lord. While we're in Memphis, we had a real treat. Elo Sanderson came to chapel on his 75th birthday. Okay, a little bit of perspective. When you're in your 20s, 75 seems a little bit older. I'm 72. It doesn't seem quite as old now, okay? But here was this wonderful man who was the editor of some of our earliest hymn books back into the 30s and things. And he came and spoke in chapel, and we were able to ask questions. And if you'll turn to the back of the handout, this is where I want us to start today. I had it laid out and forgot, didn't bring it. But I grew up singing out of Christian Hymns number 2, which was a small brown, like dark tan hymnal. And the editor was Elo Sanderson. And so as he gave his chapel presentation, he said, "Don't ask me why, But he said for some reason, 20s, 30s, early 40s, the Church of Christ would not sing a song if they knew that the same person had written the words and the music. He said, don't ask me why, but he said for some reason, we just didn't like to sing a song if we knew that the same person had written both of them. And then he kind of looked around and he said, I couldn't really say this, but if you look in my hymn book, there are 13 songs in which I was the editor and the writer of the hymn. And immediately somebody said, how did you do that? And he said, well, if you look on some of my songs, you'll see L.O. Sanderson on the right-hand side, which is the words. And he said, Vanna R. Ray is the maiden name of my mother. And so, 13 of the hymns in Christian Hymns number 2 had the dubious distinction of being written by the same person, but we would not have bought his hymn book, we wouldn't have sung out of it for some reason if we had known that he was writing both the words and the music. And so that was just one of those very interesting things, because here's a man who spent decades of his life doing that. And what a wonderful song, you know, the world has lost the right of prayer, saints have failed to pray, come in the morning, pray in the morning. And there's various songs through this hymn book. But what was interesting is that while he's speaking in chapel, it may not have been just that semester, but I was also taking a class on the book of Psalms, and our teacher spent a lot of time talking about how did the Psalms come together and how did this wonderful hymn book take place. I was able to ask him two questions, though, and we're going to open with the first one and close with the second one. I asked him, I just said, Brother Sanderson, well, and let me take a step back. Brother Sanderson came and did singing workshops. Sarah is actually halfway to Amarillo. There was a train line originally, and the foreman of the train line from Oklahoma City to Amarillo was Mr. Sayre, so that's where we got our name, and we're 25 miles from the Texas line. But I'm guessing 3 or 4 times Brother Sanderson came and did a singing workshop, which was just fabulous to have the man with the background in the singing. But I asked him, I said, Brother Sanderson, in your hymns, what is the favorite line of your hymns? And he said, I'm glad you asked. That one's easy. He said, the favorite line in my hymn is the 3rd verse of Be With Me, Lord. And then he just quietly said, Be with me, Lord, no other gift or blessing thou couldst bestow could with this one compare, a constant sense of thy abiding presence where'er I am, to feel that thou art near. And then he paused and laughed a little bit, and he said, you know, he said, the 3rd verse of a song is kind of like the front row of a church building. It's there, but it's not used like the rest of the rows are. And he said, if I had to do it over, I would actually move the 3rd verse probably to the 2nd so that more people would sing it. And then he paused, and he said, may I tell you something interesting about this? He said, a thought would be in my mind, and it would just kind of stay there. And today we'd probably say like putting something in the crock pot, you know, just kind of be sitting there stewing. And he said, I'd just been thinking about this whole thing about God with us and being with God and on and on. And he said, one morning at 2 o'clock, I just couldn't go to sleep. And I got up in about 30 to 40 minutes, all 4 verses of Be With Me, Lord, just came rushing out of my mind. And he said it had been sitting there for a long time. And he said, about 10 days later, I got some music from a dear friend. And he said, the only time this happened, he said, we did a number of songs together. But he said, when I got the music, I looked, and the words and the music of Be With Me, Lord, I didn't have to change one note. So he said, I had to pick up the phone. And if you'll notice, T.O. Chisholm, in our hymn book for Be With Me, Lord, is the one who wrote the music. And so he said, I picked up the phone and I called Brother Chisholm and I said, when did you write this? And he said, the other morning about 2 o'clock, I just had this hymn running through my mind and it just wouldn't go away. And I just had to get up. And he said, it took me about an hour, And so here are two dear, dear friends, miles apart, unknown to each other, and the words and the music of Be With Me, Lord are written by two brothers separated from distance but had worked together and had done other stuff. And he said, usually I had to change a few notes or change a little bit. And he said, the only time I ever got a song from somebody and it just went click like this and stuck together. So through that experience of listening to him and knowing he was the editor of the hymn book, then that caused me to do some thinking about our psalms that are in that. So if you want to start with the writing, the collecting of the psalms, there'll be a lot of this I'll have to leave with those of you who are Bereans to look at more details. We'll do some highlights as we go through, but I want you to notice this. The songs in Israel's hymn book came from her walk with God through the centuries. And I want us just to be thinking about what was the process by which these hymns were written. So let's just start with this. The earliest known psalm in terms of the headings is Psalm 90, and that's going to be Moses. Moses is roughly going to be around 1500. Some will say a little bit later, but let's just say 1500. There are other psalms that are written after the exile, which is down into the 500s. So when I pick up the book of Psalms, I think I'm reading a hymn book that the boundaries of the hymn book are nearly 1,000 years. And how many changes have taken place in Israel's history from the time Moses is leading the people out of the wilderness until God brings the people back from captivity, back from Babylonian captivity and back from exile. In the middle, David attributed 73 psalms in the book of Psalms, and at least twice in a book like Acts, O David said. So typically you'll find David writes 75 of the psalms, but our boundaries are Moses with Psalm 90 and psalms that collect all the way back to the exile. While I was in school in Memphis, they made an announcement one day, and they said, Carl Burkeen is going to be speaking at Highland tomorrow at 10 o'clock on spirituality. And if you're an older generation, Paul Faulkner and Carl Burkeen did these marriage seminars and on. But his topic was announced as spirituality, and I just thought, I just have to go and listen. And he talked about, you know, the kids were gone, wonderful wife, her name was Smitty, that's what they both called her. And he said, but typically I always get up an hour beforehand. She loves the smell of coffee, I put the coffee pot on. And so I'm usually up at least an hour before my wife gets up. Sometimes I fix her breakfast. But he said, I always have my quiet time with God, open God's word. And he said, that's how I start my day every day. And then here it came. He said, if you haven't done this, I would like to recommend you to do something, which I'm going to do the same. He said, my favorite spiritual discipline is to read 5 psalms each day and 1 chapter from Proverbs. 5 times 30 is what? 150. And so in my book of Psalms, and you can do it out of your head, like if it's the 10th, 5 times 10, oh, we're going to end on 50, so we're going to do 46 through 50. If there are 31 days, I do one day for Psalm 119 because it's so long. But you stop and think about it. Teacher, what is the first and greatest commandment? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. And when I read through the book of Psalms, I think primarily in terms of my vertical relationship with the Creator. And then as I read the book of Proverbs, I'm thinking primarily of the need for wisdom in terms of how I conduct myself and how I live in terms of horizontally. I say this kindly, and if you know my family, there's no criticism here. As we get older, we need an additional sense of wisdom of either when or when not to say or do something. Okay? Like, for example, I can say things to my 2 daughters that I'm not going to say to my daughter-in-law. Not as a negative, but just as a reality. I can pull my son aside and put an arm around him and say, matey, we need to talk about this. And I can say something to Luke that I'm not going to say to Mike Mitchell. Jess DeBoard lived just to the west of the Choctaw School, long-term elder at Eastside, and he said, you know, the older that I get, the more I realize the need to have wisdom with my speech and what I say and how I conduct myself. So since 1974, 75, every January, firstly without fail, I read through 5 chapters of Psalms, 1 chapter of Proverbs, and typically do that about 4 or 5 times a year. So I just encourage you, we're coming up close, and you can start any time, but we're coming up close to the first. And if you have never done that, I would just encourage you to read through Israel's hymn book, and the same way that we like to taste good food with our tongue, then taste these with your ear and with your eye, and listen to the hymn book of Israel, and that's just, that can be a blessing in your life like very few other things are. That's hands. Head is things we think about, and this is what I already mentioned. History, this is what Israel did. The books of Psalms, this is how they felt. And the reason we're doing the summary here, I just ran these down. You'll do the United Kingdom, you'll have the three kings, and then the kingdom divides in 931, north and south. The northern kingdom goes away in 721, and then it's Judah alone, and the first captives are carried off in 606. Daniel, a next group are carried away in 598, 597, Ezekiel, and then 586, 587, the city is destroyed. And Jeremiah writes in chapter 29, oh, God's people are going to be in captivity for 70 years. Daniel 2:9, Daniel is reading Jeremiah in captivity. He was carried off with the first group. He knows when it's going to end, and God sends the people back. And that will become a part of our discussion here in a second, but I'll leave you to look at those different events. There are 5 books, and this had to be intentional. When you read through the books of history, there are other psalms. Some are very similar, some are not here. I'm sure there were other psalms that were written. At some point, editors had to decide which psalms come in and which psalms come out. But I read an interesting quote recently, and the guy said, Moses gave us 5 books of the law. And through David's influence, through worship, there ended up being 5 books in the hymn book. And what you'll notice at the end, like for example, the end of 41 and the end of 72, there will be a doxology at the end of each one of these different books. So if you look at number 1, 38 of the first 41 Psalms are composed by David. Very appropriate, the sweet singer of Israel. The sons of Korah have a whole group of psalms in number 2, and then you'll find some are also going to be in book number 3. We're going to spend more time with number 3 tonight, though, and that's the family of Asaph. And you'll find, and I did a list, Psalm 50, and then there's a collection from 73 down through 83. And let me go ahead and give you the bottom line tonight. What we have in the family of Asaph is a record of 600 years of a family that faithfully worships God. And what you'll find is that Asaph is appointed by David along with others to help lead the worship. They're going to bring the tabernacle in and they start doing things. Solomon's going to start building the temple. And the leader, the Israelites wouldn't say the leader, the band. But you know what I'm trying to say when I say that. The leader of the worship in Israel is going to be Asaph. David is at 1,000. If you notice, I put these in bold with an asterisk. Psalm 74 and 79 speak of Jerusalem and the temple's been burnt and the walls have been torn down. We're down into the exile. And so when I read Psalm number 3, can I say the grandfather? You know what I'm trying to say? Asaph is the grandfather, and he starts this tradition, but through the years, and we're going to see this in a second, every time there's a restoration movement. Do you know what I mean by restoration movement? Oh, we are going to do things like our father David did. And every time that happens, whether it's Hezekiah, doesn't make any difference who it is, any of these great men who call people back, Guess what the first thing they do is? Where's the family of Asaph? And they've either had to go work, they've had to take care of business or whatever. But think about this. We have a record from David at 1,000 to Ezra and Nehemiah rebuilding the wall, 444. We have a record of 600 years. Every time we're going to do it like our father David did, the first thing we do is, where's the family of David? I have this in print later, and young people, you may need to ask your parents what I mean by this. But the family of Asaph are the Jacksons and the Osmonds of the Hebrew family. If you don't understand what I'm talking about, ask your parents or grandparents, and they'll be able maybe to explain that. Our dear friend Charlie Powell went with us to Australia, and I still just kind of shudder. Charlie took maybe 2 piano lessons and 3 guitar lessons, and anytime he heard a song through the day or through the night, he had to go home and play the song before his mind would let him go to sleep that night. He went to see Amadeus. He said, I had to go to the early showing because he had to go home and play every song that he heard written by Mozart before his mind would let him go to sleep. How scary is that? Same thing with the guitar. And so we would do 4th of July. July is wintertime in Australia. We'd still get together, and Charlie would have his guitar. Well, you don't need to read music if you do everything by rote. So it was no surprise his 4-year-old son went over and went, ding, middle C on the piano. There are some things genetically passed along. There are some families that just have that musical bend to them. But here's what's significant. Not only is the family of Asaph musically inclined, they're faithful. And I dare you to try to find another family in the Bible that you can trace 600 years that every time we're going to do it like our father David did, every time we're going to go back to the book, every time we're going to start singing praises to God, guess who we find? Where's the family of Asaph? And we'll come to this in a second. Book number 4, number 9, starts with Psalm 90 with Moses. And what I love about this is that when you read through this collection, the majority of these songs either speak about the beauty of God's creation or they speak about the history of Israel. And what did Moses write about in Genesis? In the beginning, God created. And these wonderful things about the trees clap their hands and the brooks gurgle and sing and all this other stuff in nature. Or this is what God did. Then when you come to the 5th book, there's again a series of collections that are there. There's a number of songs after the exile. The Hallel is sung during the Passover. If this is the temple and we bring the lambs in for the killing of the Passover, there are usually like 3 different killings that took place, and they'd bring the lambs in, and the singers would start singing Psalm 113 through 18, and they would rotate through that. You bring the lamb up, get ready, a little bit gross. Slit his throat, the priest takes some blood, takes the blood back. You take the lamb back to prepare for the Passover. They're going to do that at least 3 times. But Psalms 113 through 118, the Hallel, is sung during the killing of the Passover lamb and also during the observance of the Passover. Songs of Ascent, Jerusalem, the city set on a hill. As the pilgrims are traveling to Jerusalem, remember Jesus and his family are doing that in Luke chapter 2. Then they would sing the songs of ascent as they made the journey, the pilgrimage, up the hill to go there. My grandparents lived south of us, west of Mangum. My dad was up a lot of mornings at 4:30, and we'd have the 6 or 7 cows milked, the chickens fed, everything else. But he wanted to be at his grandparents' house as the first rays of sunlight came up over the hill. So on Christmas morning, we'd get up at 4:30. This was a real treat for Christmas. Get all the stuff fed, everything done, presents in the car, and on. But on the way, we would sing, over the river and through the woods, to grandmother's house we go, the horseless way, the carriage. And that was the song that we sang all the time as we got closer and closer to our grandparents' house. And Dad was perturbed if the sun was up a little bit by the time we got there because he wanted the sun to come up while he was in the driveway of his father-in-law's house. But we saved that song, and we sang that in our family. Well, as the pilgrims, and if you're a male, you're supposed to go to Jerusalem 3 times a year, then the Psalms from 120 through 134 were the Psalms of Ascent. David, the editor of the fifth book, said, oh, there's some David Psalms that we haven't included yet. And would the book of Psalms be the same without 139? Where can I go from thy spirit? Where can I flee? Even though I take the wings of the morning, even that thou art there, even before a word is on my tongue, lo, thou knowest it altogether, Lord. And so the editor of the fifth hymn book said, oh, here are some Psalms of David that we just have to include in the collection. You'll see those that are underlined. And then Psalms of Praise. But here's something I want you to think about. Encourage you with your hands to actually read these, to actually know something about the history. But all of this is of no avail if it doesn't impact our hearts. And that's why I love the emotion. Every emotion that you're going to feel in a week's, in a month's time is going to be expressed somewhere in the book of Psalms. There are Psalms of Lament, which I read as Psalms of Faith. We had a teacher that had studied in a Jewish university for 13 years. And he said, a lot of Jews pray to God like this. And as Christians, we don't. We kind of pray to God more like this. And you read these laments, God, why did you let this happen? And if you live long enough, you will have some things happen to you where you will wonder, God, why did you let this happen? And there is an expression for every emotion that we're going to feel in the book of Psalms. We had a godly lady in Australia who had lived in a church that went up and down, 2 preachers left, and on it went. And she had been a Christian for 60 years. And I asked her, I said, Sister Shaw, how have you stayed faithful? And she was Scottish, always immaculately dressed. And she started quoting Psalm 27. She said, Thou hast said, seek ye my face. And then she just touched herself right here. She said, I have said in my heart, Thy face, O Lord, will I seek. No one can turn you away from God but you. The other 11 apostles didn't stop believing in Jesus because of what Judas did. And how often, Marty, have you heard someone say, that bunch of hypocrites at such and such a place, or so-and-so says they're a Christian. The only person that can pull you away from God is yourself. And that's why these Psalms are so important, because they engage all these different aspects of our life. Thy word, a lamp to our feet, and a light to our way. If you turn the next page, here is Asaph, and what I had done just kind of on the slant while ago, notice these dates. Again, David, 1,000, Solomon, 962, 922. And these other men that are here are men who are restoration leaders. I like our term, restoration. What you're going to have is that in the northern kingdom, you're going to have 19 kings from 931 to 721. In the southern kingdom, you're going to have 20 kings from 931 to 606. And out of that 20 kings, 6 are good most of the time. 3 or 4 of them are really worth their salt, which, again, is not a very good track record. But here's what I want you to notice. See Jehoshaphat, 873, 849. Hezekiah, 715, 687. Josiah, he's the last good king, 640. Ezra, Nehemiah. And if you look on the left-hand side, the numbers 1 through 6 go with the men across the top, 1 through 6. Everybody see what I'm saying? So a part of this I'll leave you to read later in terms of the details. But notice 1 Chronicles 6:31. Asaph was one of those in charge of the music in the Lord's temple. The singers are Heman and Asaph and Ethan, and both of those you'll meet later. 1 Chronicles 16:4 and 5. Asaph was the chief. 16:7, David entrusted Asaph and his relatives with the task of singing songs of thanksgiving to the Lord. Give thanks to the Lord, call on his name. 16:37, he left Asaph and his relatives to serve continually in front of the ark of the Lord, the service with Asaph and Heman. And so here we start, and here, let's just call him grandfather, and you know what I'm trying to say. Here's the original Asaph, and David gives him very specific responsibilities, and you can fill in some more of the details there. But one of the greatest contributions that David made was the instilling of the worship to God. Warrior, yes. King, yes. And a lot of other things. But in terms of longevity and history, David's establishment of worship was one of those most wonderful things. And so when you come to number two, here's Solomon. He dedicates the temples, and guess who's going to be singing? Asaph and Heman. You come to Jehoshaphat and see him number three on the top. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Jehazel, a Levite of the sons of Asaph. You let a few more years go by, the cleansing of the temple with Hezekiah. He commanded the Levites to sing the words of David and Asaph the singer, and they sang praises with gladness and bowed down in worship. Number five, 2 Chronicles 35:15, Josiah, the last of the good king, the singers, the sons of Asaph, the command of David. And then the people go into captivity. Ezra the scribe, Nehemiah, who comes back to rebuild the wall, are there. And guess who we have? We're going to bring back from captivity with Ezra 128 of the sons of Asaph. And they're going to praise God according to the directions of David the king. You see what I'm saying? Every time we're going to come back and say, let's restore the worship. Let's do things like God said through David. Guess how we do that? We pull in the family of Asaph. And these godly people are worshiping God faithfully through the ups and the downs, through captivity. It doesn't matter what it is. When it comes time to say, are we going to sing? Where's the family of Asaph? So they sang responsively, praising and giving thanks to the Lord. We're now in Nehemiah, the singers of the sons of Asaph. Oh, he brings 148 of them. So do you see what begins to happen? All these people are carried off into captivity, but both Ezra and Nehemiah note, oh, when we started bringing people back and we're going to reestablish the worship and we're going to eventually rebuild the temple and we're going to get all of this stuff started again, guess who's there? The family of Asaph, which to me is just absolutely amazing. 11:17, the son of Asaph was the leader, began the thanksgiving in prayer. The priest, you'll see the same thing. 12:46, in the days of David and Asaph of old, there was a chief of the singers, and there were songs of praise and thanksgiving to God. So I've said this, but just let this sink in. Isn't this amazing that for 600 years, every time we're going to do it right, every time we're going to go back to the book, every time we're going to do it like our father David asked us to do it, guess who they call in? Well, you look at what happens in between. With all these ungodly kings, you know, there's a period of time that the temples, they nail the doors of the temple shut. They've got to be self-supporting somehow. We're not told all the details about it. And then when a restoration movement happens, we open the temple up, we do this, and they come back in. And then as soon as something happens and they're cast out, it doesn't matter politically, it doesn't matter socially, and it doesn't matter economically what's going on. This family is committed to praising and worshiping God. Isn't that amazing? And through all of the ups and downs, and like I said, you go from David to the very, very end, and we're bringing, it's over 900 miles, a four-month journey from Babylon. You have to go up the Fertile Crescent to come back, and we're going to bring back 128 with one group, 148. And so that's why when I read the third book, starting in Psalm 73, which is close to halfway, guess what I think about? When I see Asaph, then I get to thinking, oh, get to looking at these people and their history and where they came from. And here is a family that, because they have been worshiping God over all this time, The original grandfather is going to be at 1,000. We have two of the hymns that we noticed are down in the exile. So I see the book of Asaph as a family edited volume of the book of Psalms. These are the people who at least collected and put those words and those things together. And like I said, I hate to do generational things. And young people, if you're in the dark, ask your grandparents who the Jacksons and the Osmonds were, and they'll be able to fill you in on the inside of that. Last page, and we'll just do some highlights. Here's my question. If Christ doesn't come back for another 600 years, will there be somebody in your family that's worshiping? And when you read the 78th Psalm written by the family of Asaph, we will not hide these in verse 4 from their children, but we will tell them to the coming generation the deeds of the Lord. And he commanded to teach our children that, notice, the next generation, and this is the children talking about their next generation, and the children yet unborn will rise and tell them to their children. Isn't that amazing in Psalm 78? Guess who did that? The family of Asaph. You do not intentionally and purposely worship God for 600 years by accident. And when you look at all the people who fell away and all the distractions and all the other things that happened and all the church the leaders of the Israelites who were unfaithful, this family, it didn't matter what was going on economically or politically, they had one driving purpose, and that was, we're going to worship God. Now, there's a whole bunch of verses here that we won't be able to get to. I'll leave these for you to look at. But look at the thing. Teach these things diligently to their children. I love Genesis 18, 17 through 19. It's about the second or third one. Abraham charged his children to keep the way of the Lord. And you'll read all these things through different generations and the stuff that will happen. I want you to drop down to just above, be faithful all of your life. John 6:47. It will be written in the prophets, they shall all be taught by God, and everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me. Bring our children up in what? The nurture and admonition of the Lord. So here's some exhortations. One, regardless of what my children or grandchildren may do, it's important that I make the commitment to be faithful. Nothing replaces faithfulness. I was doing premarriage counseling with a couple who were actually sleeping together, which if they're asking me to do their wedding, I always kind of talk about it. I said, guys, we need to sort this out. They came back the next week, and the comment was, we got to thinking, unless we make some changes in our lives, we will never become like our godly grandparents. And we have repented of some things, and we're not going to have relations until we get married in hopes that someday we can come. The grandparents had no idea. But what was going on? Here they were growing up, and they had an example of faithfulness. There's aspects of faith that are taught. There are aspects of faith that are caught. And having godly people in your heritage can be a real blessing in that sense. Walter Brueggemann asked an interesting question. He has a whole chapter on this. It's appropriate as a church that we ask, will our children have faith? And he wrote an entire chapter and said, will our faith have children? And when you stop and think about it, in the Lord's church, we can have physical descendants of faith, but as we teach people and bring them out of darkness into the light, guess what has happened? How many people have become Christians because of listening to Mike's programs? And so we need to ask specifically and be very focused on, will our physical children have faith? But we also need to be asking, is my life such that my faith will have children? And guess what? The family of Asaph has both of these things going on, or they wouldn't have stayed faithful. And look at the amazing part of that. Have you ever known anybody to fall away who worships three times a week? Have you ever thought about that? Mike, can you name anyone that you know that has left the church and left the Lord who worships faithfully three times a week? What happens if I fall away? I quit worshiping. How did the family of Asaph stay faithful for 600 years? Worship was at the center and the heart and soul of their family culture. And that's why I wanted to bring this family to your attention. You think, yes, there are things out of our control, but shouldn't we be praying yet for generations yet unborn if Christ doesn't come back? And praying that faithfulness will be a part of their life. I'm going to do this very quickly, but I'd like you to listen very carefully. I had the blessing of growing up in a godly, and this is on my dad's side. Grandfather was an elder, godly people. The other side of my family, my grandfather is an atheist and he's an alcoholic. Can I do this? And so with one family, when we had Thanksgiving, 90 to 100 people will come. And Marty, if it's at your house, all you need to do is either four turkeys and five hams or five hams and four turkeys, and we'll bring the tables and everything else. But if you have 110 people together for Thanksgiving, that's quite an event. But guess what would happen every time? About 60 of us would get together and sing. Better than turkey, better than pumpkin pie, and families blend in a way that the rest of us don't. On the other side, my mom's brother was probably, as far as we can tell, involved in cattle rustling. Okay, get ready. This is going to be a little bit gross. In the 20s and 30s, if you got caught rustling cattle, there were times that they took the guy to the nearest cottonwood tree and hung him and called the family and told him where he was at, because this is people's livelihood. And he nearly got caught twice. And he ran away, ended up living in California. He would call our house, and my mom could talk to him for about 2 minutes, and then she would just start crying and hand me the phone, and so I ended up talking with him a number of times. Toward the end of his life, he called and he said, "Would you ask your father, my dad, to go speak to the grandfather and tell him I have cancer, I probably won't live for another 6 months, could I please come home and see my mom and dad? I won't go into town. Can I just come and see my family one more time before I die?" And the grandfather said, "We don't ever want to see you again." The last time I talked with him, he said, "The landlady will dispose of my things and I'll be buried in an unmarked grave. Will you please go tell my grandfather I will never do anything again too embarrassing?" About 3 years ago, my son was in Sacramento, and his mother-in-law had got on the genealogy and found him with a plaque buried in a military cemetery in Sacramento. So far as I can tell, I've made 47 trips to Australia, and nearly every time landing on the West Coast, I think somewhere down here, I have an uncle buried in an unmarked grave who wasn't welcome home. My grandmother, the elder's wife, we had party lines, so you can hear a lot of stuff on a party line. But here's the other side. Son, you can never go anywhere or do anything, but what if you will call your grandfather and I, we will get you home. Which family do you want to be a part of? And see, when we think of the blessing of being a forever family, as Christians, what does forever mean for us? And I can't tell you the grief that has been in my life to have one of my grandfathers who tells a blood son, "I don't ever want to see you again. I don't ever want you to come home." And he didn't. And Marty, how would you feel dying in California all by yourself and knowing that your own father has said, I don't ever want to see you again. And what happened in the parable of the father's son? What's that father doing every day? Looking down the road to see if he will come back. And that's why we as Christians are in a forever family. Till death do us part in this life. But guess what? We get to go home and be together forever. So I want to encourage you to think about the example of the family of Asaph and think about our own families. Yes, what can we do in our families and in this church to see that our children grow up having faith? But also, what can we do to make sure that our faith is also having children? As chapel ended, I was able to ask Brother Sanderson one more question. And to get out of him, the third verse of Be With Me, Lord, was his favorite verse, was just a gem. So you can imagine, I can't ever sing Be With Me, Lord, now, and I just hear, no other gift or blessing thou couldst bestow could with this one compare, a constant sense of thy abiding presence where'er I am, to feel that thou art near. Just before chapel closed, I said, Brother Sanderson, outside of your hymns, what is your favorite line in the hymn book? He said, oh, that's easy. When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun.